One edge of the galaxy, not yours. 17 years ago, the palace ballroom was awash with landed gentry, well-bred ladies, the nouveau riche, minor nobility, major celebrities, and other luminaries. The men's formal wear had simple lines, but many jackets were encrusted with military orders and other medals that reflected the flashes from the immense crystal chandelier hanging overhead. The ladies sported piled-up hairstyles and elaborate gowns made of shimmering metallic fabrics that constantly changed color as they glided about, admiring their reflections in the ballroom's floor-to-ceiling mirrors. Near the corner of one of several overladen buffet tables stood the Marquis Ormi Oribastra, a tall, imposing man with a yellow sash secured across his barrel chest by a large, jeweled badge of honor that left no doubt as to his noble status. Above his full gray beard, sharp, dark eyes roved the crowd, and he occasionally nodded a polite greeting to anyone he deemed important enough to deserve one.
Far be it from me to turn down a free party at the Varsess Palace. But really, Father, don't you find the whole thing a bit insulting? All glitz and glitter aside. Hey!
Next to the Marquis, his 18-year-old son stopped a passing waiter and snagged his fifth drink of the evening from the tray the waiter barely managed to keep from dropping. As his father glared disapprovingly, the young man took a healthy swig from his latest highball. Where his father was thick, he was wiry. His dark hair was shaved on the sides of his head and long on the top, in a style favored by the radicals and malcontents that swarmed the less fashionable parts of the city these days.
It is the highest honor to be invited to the coronation, Lazaro.
More like a slap in the face to me. A reminder that our only future is our little manor, our little plot of land, a hereditary crown that's made us vassal to a child.
Enough!
The Marquis glanced around. No one seemed to have noticed the brief breach of etiquette. He turned discreetly toward his son.
I've given you a wide berth, Lazaro. I've looked the other way on your political activities, but I want one night of peace. One night where you respect the proper order of things. One night where you're the future Marquis Oribastra and not some bomb-throwing anarchist.
Lazaro smirked, raised his glass in a mocking toast, and downed the remainder of his highball in one dramatic gulp. He firmly set the empty glass next to the cluster of other empty glasses on the corner of the buffet, just as the massive double doors to the great hall opened. Lazaro looked back at his father and shrugged.
One night.
They both joined the slowly shuffling crowd that filed toward the great hall and the solemn ceremony to come. Lazaro spent the next hour and a half sitting on a hard bench, not listening to speeches, accolades, recitations, homilies, and choral hymns. When he dozed off and his head drooped too far forward or back, the Marquis would elbow him awake, and he would scowl darkly until he dozed off again. Finally, Lazaro was allowed to stand with everyone else as the soon-to-be queen's procession started down the center aisle of the great hall. He didn't realize his ass had gone numb until the pins and needles started. He tried to rub some feeling back into his butt cheeks,
ow,
causing his father to drive an elbow into his ribs again. Everyone far from the aisle bobbed and weaved, straining to catch a glimpse of the long train of higher-ranking nobility and clerics that preceded the queen's palanquin. Lazaro barely moved. He stared passively at the back of the elaborate pile of hair on the head of the woman in front of him. The pile was topped off by a little hat that resembled some sort of alien crustacean. Then his curiosity got the better of him as the crowd's reaction indicated the princess herself was about to pass by. He craned his neck around the crab hat and caught a glimpse. Atop a pillow, atop the ornate palanquin, borne by four muscular retainers, sat a tiny girl. Lazaro knew she was 8 years old, but seated, buried under brocaded robes, she looked even younger, smaller, like a doll. Her face was painted with bright red spots on her cheeks, a blue dot on her chin, and a yellow dot between her eyes, which were themselves outlined with heavy black lines. Her hair was braided around her hairline to accommodate the crown that would soon be placed on her head, but the rest of it puffed out in a glossy nimbus around her face. Lazaro relaxed again as the palanquin passed him. The kid had stared straight ahead, motionless, expressionless. How aware was she of what was going on in the world outside the palace? She had to be too young to understand the full implications of the hurricane-strength shitstorm that she was about to inherit. A smirk twisted the corner of Lazaro's mouth. None of them understood, really. But they would, soon enough. The flock of nobles and clerics had peeled off to roost around the edges of the large dais, under the gleaming arches at the front of the great hall. The burly retainers carefully mounted the stairs to the middle of the dais, slowly swung the palanquin around so the princess faced the crowd, and carefully set it down. As they backed away, the archbishop stepped forward and stood directly behind the princess. His formal robe was white, trimmed with gold, and embroidered with a large golden stylized bird with spread wings, the symbol of Ariopan royalty. The archbishop's tall golden headdress reminded Lazaro of a vase, maybe a flower pot. He imagined dead, decaying vegetation drooping over the edges of it and smirked again. The archbishop gestured formally to a robed attendant who slowly walked to him, carrying a rose-colored velvet pillow that dripped golden tassels. The pillow paled in comparison to the crown that rested on it. The broad gold circlet supported a golden-winged bird of Ariopa, encrusted with a fortune in jewels. Lazaro unconsciously bared his teeth. That crown was worth enough money to provide grain to hundreds of thousands of starving people, maybe even a million. The archbishop lifted the crown from the pillow, faced the crowd, and raised it high over his head. Lazaro glanced at his father's face. There was a self-satisfied gleam in his eye and a superior smirk on his lips. That look was reflected in every other smug, elitist face that Lazaro could see. He clenched his fists and told himself over and over that their arrogance wouldn't last much longer.
"You are crowned Queen Aldea the 23rd, Guardian of the House of Belior, Duchess of Arses, Princess Regent of Monacos, Empress of the Third Spiral, and Queen of Heaven."
He lowered the circlet toward Aldea's small head. The little girl's large dark eyes looked upward as the crown of the Beliors settled into place.
"Long live the Queen!"
Lazaro looked again at the back of the piled-up hairdo and the ludicrous hat. He imagined the swish of an axe, the head toppling from the shoulders in a shower of arterial blood. No one saw his feral grin.
"Yes, long live your precious queen."
Queen Aldea squirmed a little as she sat on the throne. Her formal robes were hot and itchy. The throne was too tall for her, so there was a tufted ottoman under her feet, partially concealed by the robes. If she didn't have the ottoman there, she tended to swing her legs nervously. The coronation crown had been put back in a vault under the palace, and for today's audience, she wore one of several smaller tiaras. Gold chains hung from the circlet and framed Aldea's round face. It wasn't as heavy as the crown, but it still gave her a headache after a while. Around her, in the ornate throne room, with its massive columns carved of semi-precious stone, stood several royal guards carrying spears, weapons that were more ritual than practical. At Aldea's side stood her beautiful mother, Irene, in a simple draped blue gown and flat gold collar. She was not to be the center of attention. That was reserved for the queen. A few meters from the bottom of the stairs leading up to the throne was a crowd of petitioners representing various planetary systems within the purview of the Empire. Irene beckoned a woman forward. She walked up the wide carpet to the bottom of the stairs, bowed, and knelt. Aldea knew people were required by custom to do this, but it made her feel uncomfortable. Like she should wave or say hello or just smile at least in return, but she'd been told not to. She hoped she'd get used to it someday. She turned toward her mother.
Who is this?
Irene leaned in close.
This is Aya Vuluo, the governor of Palace, and an intractable thorn in your grandfather's side.
Intractable?
That means annoying. Palace is a minor colony, but Vuluo seems to believe it deserves special attention.
Irene straightened again and nodded her permission for Aya to speak.
Holy Queen, Light Divine, my people send me to you seeking justice. Palace is a mining colony. We depend on food shipments to survive, but transports aren't meeting the need. We need more food. I'm not even asking you to send us any, but please, grant us the dispensation to direct some of our industrial workforce to agriculture.
Aldea felt bad for the lady. She got hungry sometimes herself, and her tummy would grumble. But if it was close to lunchtime or dinner, her nanny might tell her she couldn't have a snack because it would spoil her meal. She didn't like being hungry and didn't want anyone else to feel that way either. Besides, Aya seemed nice, not intractable. She looked up at her mother.
That doesn't sound like much.
But her mother's face was stern.
Palace is the largest producer of neutral metals in their sector. Any decline in production would cause critical shortages.
What does that mean?
We need them where they are.
Aldea started to stand on the ottoman.
Let me speak to her.
No.
Irene held a firm hand on her daughter's shoulder and looked down the stairs at Aya.
Your petition will be taken under consideration, but resources are stretched thin. In the meantime, send your people the Queen's blessings.
Aya's eyes went wide, and her mouth opened a little. Then she looked at Aldea, right into her eyes, and she looked so sad that Aldea felt her throat get tight like she was going to cry. But the guards moved close to the lady and helped her to her feet, and she walked away with her head down as the next petitioner started down the carpet toward the throne. A couple of hours later, although it seemed like a whole day to Aldea, she was standing on a stool in her bedroom as attendants removed her formal robes and tiara. Her mother stood off to one side, supervising.
Are we going to help that poor lady?
The last of the satin petticoats was pulled over Eldea's head, leaving her standing on the stool in her underclothes. It felt wonderful.
No, my daughter, we are not.
Her relief was forgotten as she frowned at her mother in confusion.
That's dumb. Isn't a queen supposed to help people?
Irene waited as two attendants carted off the formal clothes, and another brought a simple light day dress and helped Aldea slip into it. The woman started to tie the ribbons at the neck of the dress, but Irene motioned her away. She nodded. Irene walked up to her daughter and gently put her hands on the girl's shoulders.
Yes, you are supposed to help people, but the kingdom is more important than any single part of it. Every change has consequences elsewhere. Let Palace lower metal production, and the economy of Vor collapses. Redirect food transports, and Cestus starves.
But they're already starving.
Irene shook her head and started tying the ribbons to close the neck of the dress.
It's a complicated web, this kingdom of yours. And things never end up exactly where they need to, exactly when they need to. It's a problem.
Irene took her daughter's face in her hands.
And it's not one you can solve by giving in to the governor of Palace. It's her job to solve this. It's yours to learn to be the best queen you can. That way, one day you'll know how you can fix things. Now, let's eat.
They joined hands, and Aldea jumped off the stool.
The servants have laid out a glorious meal for you.
Awesome. I love glorious meals.
Fifteen years ago.
These fools don't understand. We're not only here because of the massacre of protesters on Huya Prime, or because of the Queen suspending Parliament last week.
Lazaro Oribastra was so high on adrenaline, he thought he might levitate. This was where he belonged.
No, those are merely the latest outrages atop the thousand years of murder and starvation that has kept the divine monarchy in place.
Over the last 2 years, he had risen through the ranks of the Revolutionary Council, bribing, blackmailing, manipulating, and intimidating his way, if not to the top, at least to within easy striking distance of it.
You and your children are starving. How often have you gone without bread? How often do you believe they have? These are the wages of having a child queen atop a monarchy that calls her a god.
But though the acquisition of authority was gratifying, his greatest satisfaction came from standing in front of a herd of ignorant nobodies and fanning the spark of their discontent into a bonfire of rage. He pumped his fist into the air.
We ought, by right, to rule ourselves!
Eldea peered around the door into her mother's room. Irene was gazing out the balcony doors at the mob, the orange glow of flames lighting her tired, worried face. An attendant waited beside her.
Hath, get the transport ready.
Yes, Eminence.
And Hath, don't frighten the queen.
Eldea stepped into the room.
I'm not a stupid baby.
Irene and Hath turned toward her as she approached.
I know what's happening. I'm not afraid.
Eldea.
They're upset about the food shortages.
And the massacres, Majesty.
Quiet.
Let me speak to them. They'll listen to me. I'm the queen. If I say night is day, it's true. So if I can just tell them to go home...
Irene grabbed her daughter's wrist.
Come here.
And pulled her to the balcony door.
Do you see those people out there?
Yes, Mother.
The crowd was pressed against the gate to the grounds of the palace. They were throwing things over the wall, and some of the objects burst into flame when they landed.
They don't see you as a god. They don't see you as anything more than an incompetent child. A child they blame for all the problems of the world.
Irene knelt and looked straight into Eldea's eyes.
They would kill you if they could. That's why we have to leave.
Not letting go of her daughter's wrist, she stood and looked outside. The mob poured through the ruined gate and even over the wall. Irene nodded to Hath.
They'll be inside the palace at any moment.
In the grand foyer of the palace, the four guards who hadn't fled or been killed were taking cover wherever they could. Behind columns, under the sweeping staircase, behind a toppled antique marble table. They knew what their duty was. Try to slow down the mob long enough for the queen to get away, then die. The guards fired into the first wave of rioters, but the next wave jumped over or trampled the bodies and kept going, pushed forward by the irresistible force of the mob that continued to pour through the ruined doors. The guards fought desperately, firing in all directions, trying to cover each other's backs. One behind a column saw rioters break through the periphery of the room to his right, flanking him. He broke cover and ran for the staircase, only to have his skull crushed by a lead pipe. His attacker pried the gun from his spasming fingers and took out a guard behind another column. Another man scrambled forward and took the dead guard's weapon. The guard behind the table was jerked to his feet and disarmed with a few punches, while the one under the staircase was dragged to the middle of the foyer and thrown to the floor. As others watched from the stairs and the second floor gallery, revolutionaries crowded around him, kicking, punching, beating him with pipes and cudgels. One man raised a small axe in the air and looked around him for approval. Smiling, the blood-spattered crowd backed away to give him room. The guard on the floor was a pulpy mess, undoubtedly already dead. But symbolic gestures were essential to violent revolutions and other turning points in history. The man with the axe waited until he had everyone's undivided attention. The last guard was dragged toward the staircase, perhaps so that he might be thrown or hung from the second floor gallery. Rioters on the edges of the crowd, whose bloodthirst had been slaked for the moment, took advantage of the distraction and started wandering off into other rooms and hallways to start looting while the pickings were good. One of the stained glass windows in the vault of the ceiling exploded, raining glass on the heads of the startled mob. Lazaro lowered his smoking weapon and walked to the center of the space, the crowd parting before him.
Remember, Our mission is to find the queen. We can loot once that's done.
He stopped at the edge of the pool of blood that was leaking from the body of the decapitated guard, holstered his weapon, and shook his head. The men who had gone from rioting to sacking, sheepishly, shuffled back into the crowd.
We are going to be an orderly mob.
One of his lieutenants caught his eye and pointed with a knife half the length of his arm to the bottom of the staircase, where a couple of men had a firm grip on a palace guard. The guard was young, about the same age as Lazaro. His nose leaked blood, and his left eye was swollen shut, the surrounding skin reddish-purple. The right eye was wide with terror. Lazaro smiled at the guard and smelled the pungent odor of urine as the poor kid pissed his pants. He had grown used to such reactions to his smiles, had grown to relish them, in fact.
Greetings, fellow citizen. Looks like you've had a really, really bad day. And I feel terrible about that. I do. And I can tell that you're scared right now, expecting to die like your unfortunate comrade over there.
Lazaro turned slightly and indicated the headless blood pudding in the middle of the floor.
But here's the thing. It doesn't have to be that way for you. If you tell me where the queen and her retinue might have gone, I can make it all go away. Help us out, and I'll tell these men to let you go. No retribution, no questions asked. How about it?
The kid closed the open eye, and a tear ran down his cheek.
Look, I understand. When you graduated from the academy, last year? You took a sacred oath to protect and defend the Empire and defer to the Goddess Queen in all things and blah, 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 and all well and good. But you have to understand that there is no Empire anymore, and the Goddess Queen has up and left you. Your sacred oath doesn't mean shit now. You've been absolved of all responsibility. Like most of the men in this room, you don't even have a job to speak of. You were part of the past, but we are the future. Help us, join us, and live.
The kid opened his eye and glanced frantically at the implacable faces all around him. Then he looked back at Lazaro, who had his head cocked slightly to the side, his face wearing the imploring expression that he had practiced for hours in the mirror until he had it just right. After only a few seconds, Lazaro saw in the kid's face that sweet, satisfying moment when he finally gave up. His head drooped forward.
Shut up, Pat. On the roof.
Well done, lad. Well done.
He nodded at his lieutenant, who had moved around behind the guard, and took a step back. The kid's head jerked up as the lieutenant's knife burst through his upper abdomen. Blood bubbled from his mouth, and his eye rolled up in his head.
All right, then, let's do this.
Lazaro stepped over the body of the guard and waited briefly as his hand-picked group of fighters assembled.
Come on!
They all bolted up the long staircase as the rest of the mob went about the business of sacking the palace. Three galleries and four staircases later, the revolutionaries reached the top floor of the palace and paused, looking around for the most likely path to the roof. Lazaro was about to tell his men to split up and search in different directions when he saw movement on the far side of the central atrium. Four people ran out of a hallway. Two men, a woman, and a child. They saw the intruders and froze. They were separated by 20 meters and a very long drop to the palace's ground floor. The child's eyes were huge as they met Lazaro's. Her mother pushed the girl behind her as the guards raised their weapons. The revolutionaries were forced to take cover before they could return fire. Through the balustrade, Lazaro saw the queen's mother open a hidden door in the wall of the gallery. He popped up and took aim, just as a guard dove between him and his target. He fell dead at the little queen's feet. The other guard provided covering fire as the queen's mother pulled her through the door, then the guard slipped through and the door closed. Lazaro and his men peppered the secret door with a few shots.
Come on!
Before running down the gallery, all the way across another, and halfway down another to the location of the secret door. Lazaro stepped over the body of the man he had shot and looked for a knob, a latch, some means to open up the barely visible door. He tried to back up so he could kick it, but ran into the dead guard. He glared at his men.
Will you get this piece of shit out of the way?
As they dragged the body aside, he stepped back and centered himself. Knowing he had broken the latch, Lazaro wedged his fingers into a couple of the holes they had shot into the door and pulled. Inside the door, the second guard lay dead. Beyond him was a short hallway, and at the end of it, a metal spiral staircase leading to a hatch in the ceiling. Lazaro could hear a shuttle warming up. Eldea was shaking hard as Irene helped her stumble up the ramp into the shuttle. They were almost inside.
Halt!
A tall man stood by the open hatch to the roof. His gun was pointed at them. Other men came through the hatch behind him.
I am placing the two of you under arrest for crimes against the Areopan people.
Before she knew what was happening, her mother had scooped her up and ducked inside.
Mama!
Irene hit the control to close the shuttle's hatch and ran to the cockpit.
Go! We need to leave now!
She put Eldea into a passenger seat and secured her seatbelt, then dropped into the co-pilot seat and strapped herself in. As the shuttle's belly thrusters lifted the ship off the pad, Eldea couldn't help but look out the window. The tall man was staring right at her. He was baring his teeth like animals she had seen in vids, horrible predators that ate other animals and even people. He looked like he wanted to eat her. Her heart pounded and she felt sick. As the shuttle's main engine blasted them away from Areopa, Eldea leaned her head back and closed her eyes. She could still see the horrible man's face. Tears ran down her cheeks as she wondered what she had done to make him hate her so much. Wisps of smoke still rose from small fires burning deep inside the charred shell of the royal palace, even days after it fell to the Glorious Revolution. Plans were in development to clean it up and eventually turn it into the seat of the new Republican government, but there was other, more important cleaning up to be done first. The grounds and formal gardens in front of the palace had been cleared of the bricks, rocks, pipe bomb debris, human feces, and dead bodies left over from the people's victory. Salvaged materials from the palace and other ruined buildings had been used to erect a spacious platform tall enough to be visible to everyone in the crowd that had been invited into the grounds. View screens were mounted on scaffolds to stream images from cameras set up around the main stage. Screens had also been installed outside the walls, so the even larger crowd in the plaza could see what was going on, and those who couldn't be there in person could watch the live broadcast from home. Robotic drones hovered overhead, capturing the festivities from above. A People's Republic deserved a people's execution. Lazaro Oribastra stood on the platform with the other leaders of the Republic, resplendent in his new uniform. Despite having already witnessed a string of beheadings, he felt calm, relaxed, even serene. He was standing right next to Admiral Kavas, so he knew he was getting plenty of screen time.
Bring forth the next subject for the people's justice!
A large man slowly mounted the stairs. His hands were cuffed behind him, his head was bent, and the front of his shirt was bloody. When he reached the platform, he stopped and glared at the officials gathered there until two guards stepped in, dragged him to the chopping block, and forced him onto his knees. Admiral Kavas raised his datapad and waited for the crowd to quiet down.
You stand charged with treason against the Areopan Revolutionary State, colluding with royalists to overthrow the people's government. How plead you, Citizen Ormi? Or should I say, the Marquis Oribastra?
Lazaro's father raised his head to look at Kavas, and one of the robot drones buzzed overhead and maneuvered in for a close-up shot. The Marquis's beard was crusted with blood from his broken nose, and a bruise had spread from his split right eyebrow to cover half his face. The sclera of his right eye was bright red.
Kill me if you must, but spare me the indignity of watching my son participate in my murder.
Kavis shot the drone a hard glance, and it obediently rose straight up and out of sight. Then he looked at Lazaro.
Go ahead.
Lazaro had disgraced himself by allowing the Queen to escape, and even though his men testified on his behalf, the Council demanded that he demonstrate his loyalty if he was going to keep his position and, frankly, his life. Lazaro gave his uniform jacket a tug and stepped forward.
How do you plead?
His father stared at him, his eyes narrowed, his lip curled. It was his standard look of disappointment verging on contempt, a look that Lazaro was familiar with from his early childhood on. He couldn't remember a moment in his father's presence when he hadn't gotten that look. A warm feeling spread through him when he realized that it no longer intimidated him. He slowly dropped to one knee so he could look directly into his father's face.
How do you plead?
The Marquis stank of sweat and old blood. He gazed balefully into Lazaro's eyes.
I should have strangled you in your crib.
Lazaro stood, and the Marquis straightened, only to be shoved down again by a guard's foot. Lazaro walked slowly toward the executioner, keeping his eyes on his father.
Do you know what the first principle of our revolution is?
He stopped by the executioner and held out his hand.
It's a pretty little phrase, almost cute, but it masks a cold truth.
The brawny bald man in the blood-spattered apron placed the handle of the laser axe in Lazaro's hand, and he walked slowly back to his father.
All the old things must pass away.
The Marquis Oribastra crouched silently for a moment, then defiantly laid his head on the chopping block. Lazaro's vision went red at the crowd's sudden silence. Even at the brink of death, his father was still determined to dominate him, grab all the attention for himself. Lazaro clutched the handle of the axe with both hands, raised it up, and pressed the switch to activate the laser.
Almost poetry.
The jerking body flopped on the block as the severed head dropped to the platform, facing Lazaro. At least the expression was no longer disappointed, just surprised. Lazaro deactivated the weapon and looked down at himself. The laser had cauterized many of the corpse's blood vessels, but the larger ones had spurted on his face and uniform. He looked at Kavis. The Admiral was smiling, pleased. Lazaro wanted to smile back, but found that he couldn't do it. Couldn't even fake it. He was just numb.
Do you think they got that?
What's that? Did who get what?
The cameras. Do you think they got it all?
Oh, I'm sure they did, my boy. Every bit.
8 years ago.
Vasco Palomar to transport Bakraya, preparing for rendezvous.
A sleek, gleaming new executive class shuttle slipped through Volane space toward a larger ship, barely more than a bright dot in the distance.
Is the cargo secure?
Inside the cockpit of the Palomar, the cargo leaned against the bulkhead a meter or so behind the pilot. Her arms were folded, her shoulders hunched. Above her scowling brows, her hair was twisted into thick ropes tipped with iridescent red dye. A small ring pierced her left nostril.
Bakraya, cargo is snug as a bug in a rug.
Oh my god.
Eldea, quiet.
I'm so sick of this! 3 months on Oro, 6 weeks on Candide, then a year on Quala, and I actually start to make friends!
Eldea jerked away from her mother and flopped into one of the passenger seats.
And now we're going to another new planet.
This is the last time we move, Eldea, I promise. This new loyalist colony is on the other side of the Ko'okolo border. They can't follow us there, not without starting a war.
For the last several years, the Queen and her mother had lived in exile, supported by an underground resistance movement against the new revolutionary government. Along the way, Irene insisted that Eldea continue her education, but now, in the event that worse came to worst, that education included basic survival skills. Both women trained in how to fly and maintain the most common types of spaceships. When they had to accept passage on ships engaged in questionable commerce, Eldea learned what she could from the captain and crew. But most of all, mother and daughter regularly practiced combat skills, both hand-to-hand and with weapons. Irene's loyal retainer and bodyguard, Hath, drilled them in martial arts techniques. And whenever they were able to stay long enough in one place, other instructors were engaged to fill in any gaps in Hath's experience. For Eldea, the practice was more than just preparation for a possible worst-case scenario. After the terrifying escape from Areopa, the little queen's sleep had often been interrupted by violent nightmares. When she was awake, the slightest provocation could send her into a screaming rage, followed by limp, blank-faced silence. Doctors along the way provided drugs and other treatments, but it was the focus and discipline of physical training that gave Eldea a safe outlet for her anger and a sense of control that kept her from falling apart. There was one affliction that all the education and martial arts in the universe couldn't cure, however. Eldea was a teenager, and there was nothing to be done about that except wait it out. She and her mother were the dinner guests of the captain of the Bak-Raya, a staunch loyalist to the Divine Monarchy. He was old and bald, and his uniform was unlike anything Eldea had ever seen. The long jacket had pads on the shoulders made of braided cords with fringe trailing off the ends. His mustache completely hid his mouth and curled up into tips so sharp it looked like they could poke his eyes out if he wasn't careful.
We are blessed today. The immortal Queen Eldea aboard my humble ship!
Irene sat straight and tall, smiling graciously at the waiter who refilled her wine glass. In honor of the occasion, she wore a simple dinner dress and her favorite necklace, a large silver pendant featuring the winged bird of Areopa that hung from a narrow chain.
What glory saluteth me! What beauty ascendeth!
Eldea, on the other hand, slouched with her elbows on the table. In honor of the occasion, she wore a skimpy shirt featuring the leering skull emblem of her favorite nihilist rock band back on Quala. The fourth person at the table, a dour clergyman in a gold-trimmed black robe, frowned at the shirt occasionally.
Truly, my queen, in thou the very heart of Areopa dwelleth.
Eldea sat back in her chair as the waiter took away her plate and tableware.
Oh my god, he's using thou.
Irene took her daughter's hand in a deceptively hard grip and smiled at the captain.
Oh, that's not necessary. The queen and I are grateful for your aid.
So grateful.
The cause will remember you.
Eldea slid further down in her chair, wishing she could keep going until she was under the table.
The protection of the queen is our top priority. The whole state of Areopa.
Such as one exists at all.
The captain shot the clergyman a withering look. The clergyman dabbed at his mouth with a napkin.
As I was saying, Areopa is vested in her, and she has no heirs. Danger to her is danger to the entire project of Areopan monarchy. If she has no children, she will be the last of the Belior dynasty. And when she dies, so will the crown.
Which, obviously, cannot be permitted.
Obviously.
Ah! Suddenly, the Bak-Raya tilted violently, sending plates and glasses flying, and the captain out of his chair.
Captain, there's an Areopan cruiser on our tail. They're firing on us.
Ah!
Eldea righted herself in her chair just in time to see the waiter pull a gun out of his waistband. The captain fell back, his brains splattered on the wall behind him. To everyone's surprise, Irene vaulted over the table and tackled the astonished waiter, whose head hit the floor hard. His gun went flying. Irene rolled over quickly, grabbed the dropped gun by the barrel, came up to her knees and raised the gun over the groggy waiter's head. Irene stood, her face and elegant dinner dress spattered with blood, and glanced around. The captain was dead. The waiter, probably so. The clergyman was also stretched out on the floor. He seemed to have fainted.
Eldea.
Her daughter stood rooted to the spot, eyes wide with shock. Irene kicked off her fashionable shoes and grabbed her daughter's wrist with the hand that wasn't holding the gun.
Eldea, we should go.
Okay.
At the end of a corridor that led to the Bak-Ria's docking port, the airlock door slid up to reveal a coterie of Ariopan troops. The troops filed into the corridor, taking up position on either side of it, and coming to attention as Commander Lazaro Ori strode in behind them. He stopped and looked around briefly.
Search the ship. Kill whoever you find, except the Queen. Bring her to me.
Lazaro bared his teeth.
I need her alive.
Irene and Aldea ran through the corridors of the unfamiliar vessel, looking for a way out.
There've got to be escape pods somewhere on this goddamn ship!
They turned a corner and passed a large door marked Engine Room. Aldea noticed the hatches and control panels in the walls.
Mom! I think I found them!
Lazaro and two members of his assault team were approaching the engine room when he saw the movement of a shadow on the wall ahead. He signaled for his men to wait, walked slowly to the corner, and stepped around it.
Wait!
The hatch to one of the escape pods was open. Aldea's head was sticking out of the opening, and Irene's hand was on the hatch. They both looked at Lazaro, eyes wide. He motioned to his men, and they stepped past the corner and moved to either side and slightly in front of him.
Move one more inch into that escape pod, and we'll turn you into a steaming ash heap.
Irene and Lazaro held each other's gaze for a moment. She didn't look afraid of him, which pissed him off to no end. In a flash, she jerked up her weapon. Lazaro dove back around the corner as his men collapsed, smoking to the floor. He poked his head back around the corner and took aim with his own gun. But his shot went wide, as Irene's shot almost parted his hair, and he had to duck back around the corner. Aldea stared at her mother, whose gaze was riveted down the hall, her gun still aimed, unwavering.
Close the hatch.
Mother!
Close it. It's 4 inches of solid metal. You'll be safe there.
She hesitated. The sight of the horrible man from her nightmares paralyzed her, and she hated herself for that. But her mother always seemed to know exactly what to do in any situation, and had always kept her safe. So Aldea swallowed her fear. She pressed her face against the thick window in the hatch. Her mother still stood there. Aldea knew she would fire a couple more shots to pin down her attacker, then get into one of the other pods, and they would both launch and be picked up later, and everything would be fine. But to her horror, her mother lowered her gun arm. Aldea could see the shadow of the horrible man approaching. Irene raised her other hand toward the wall where Aldea knew the external launch control was located. She pounded frantically on the window with her fist.
Mom! No! You can still get in! You can still...
When Aldea came to, she was dizzy and weightless. She bounced off the padded interior of the escape pod until she could maneuver herself back over to the window in the hatch. A kilometer away, she could make out the Bak-Ria, dwarfed by the bulk of the Ariopan cruiser. Around them, and around her, was the emptiness of space. But that was nothing compared to the yawning emptiness inside Aldea.
Mama!
Lazaro stood before Admiral Kavas in his office in the refurbished Royal Palace on Ariopa. Now the People's Palace. He wondered sourly what the people would think of the lavish decor Kavas favored in his office, but said nothing. Kavas toyed with a letter opener shaped like an elaborate antique dagger as he glared at Lazaro.
They got away.
Yes, Admiral.
Shocker. What a surprise that the Marquis Ori Bastra...
I abandoned that title.
Kavas slammed the letter opener down on his desk.
It is not... your turn to speak.
Lazaro kept his gaze focused on a spot on the wall above Kavas's head and ground his teeth.
What a surprise that an ex-marquis let the Queen slip through his fingers. Again.
Now Kavas stared at him expectantly. Lazaro waited until he was certain that he would be allowed to speak without another bleeding interruption.
All respect, sir. But my heritage has nothing to do with my commitment to the revolution. I led the riot that took the palace. I executed my own father. I don't know what else I can do to prove my loyalty.
Kavas revealed his yellow teeth in a mirthless grin and picked up the letter opener again.
Murder the Queen. That'd be a start.
He rotated his desk chair away from Lazaro and leaned back in it. revealing the fuzzy gray bald spot on the crown of his head. It took Lazaro a moment to realize that he had been summarily dismissed. Lazaro stood in the darkness of his own office, fuming, struggling to get his anger under control. Directly across from the door was his desk, and to either side of it were large bookshelves he had salvaged from his family home before he abandoned the crumbling pile forever. Some of the books had come from the Oribast Romance. Some he had found in storage in a far wing of the palace that had escaped the fire. His eyes settled on a massive tome with a green, tooled leather binding, a collection of mythology that he hadn't gotten around to investigating yet. His mind started wandering as he stared at the spine of the old book, as though the hidden pages were speaking to him, fragments of ancient myths that he had heard from childhood whirled around in his head until, suddenly, one of them popped into the forefront of his consciousness. In the dark, his eyes widened.
Light.
His desk lamp flared to life, and he strode to the shelves, pulled out the old book, and took it to his desk.
It's a risk. Everything is a risk.
He wedged his fingers between the pages toward the center of the book and opened it. The edges of the paper were brown, and small flakes fell off in places. The pages were illuminated with vines and flowers and alien creatures.
But if the old stories are true...
He carefully turned the pages, scanning over lettering so ornate that it was difficult to read, especially if you were used to plain text on a tablet or screen. Lazaro stood so abruptly that his desk chair rolled backward and bumped into the wall. On the page before him was a rendering of an elaborately decorated bowl supported by finely wrought metal legs. In the bowl was a lump, a gray, irregular, amorphous lump that didn't seem to deserve being displayed in such a beautiful setting. The letters above the image were large and festooned with scrollwork. They read, "The Bezoar of Kings."
Admiral Kavis will be begging me for approval.